I'm Donald MacLeod, and thanks for downloading this highlights version of Composer of the Week. There's information on all the music you'll hear, as well as our terms of use, on the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. I wonder if you can tell where I am. An area of London which has acquired a reputation as both one of the most affluent and sought-after postcodes in the city of flash addresses and a place of occasional confrontation across the race and class divide. I'm in a part of West London which was made famous around the world by a film released in 1999 with a screenplay by Richard Curtis, starring Hugh Grant, Julia Roberts, Tim McInerney, Gina McKee and Hugh Bonneville. Are you there yet? Well, the film reference certainly isn't incidental. I've come to meet my composer of the week for this week, whose career is intimately linked to the world of the big screen. She's the first composer, not of the male gender, to win an Academy Award. I won't tell you what that film award was for. That would be giving it away too easily. Although I should say it also earned our composer an Oscar. She was also the first woman composer to win a Primetime Emmy Award. Then there was the Academy nomination for The Cider House Rules and Chocolat, which also earned her a Golden Globe nomination. So, by now, you're probably getting a taste of the music of the composer I've come to visit. She's composed more than 100 scores for film, television and theatre productions. She's achieved an exceptional status whereby her film music was recently included on the A-level music syllabus. If you haven't already guessed from all those hints, let me tell you that my guest all this week and my guide through a celebration of her music is Rachel Portman. We've just heard music from a film which earned Rachel nominations for both an Academy Award and a Golden Globe, the film Chocolat. So let's hear more of her score from that film. Chocolat, which starred Juliette Binoche and Johnny Depp, is based on the book by Joanne Harris, which tells the story of how a young mother, who's an expert chocolatier, ships up in the buttoned-up French village of Lansquenet-sur-Tarn with her six-year-old daughter. Right at the beginning of Lent, she opens a chocolate shop and really begins to shake things up in the village, changing the lives of all the villagers. Colourful music written for the film Chocolat by my guest all this week, Rachel Portman. I'm sitting with Rachel in her studio in her home in London. Rachel, we just heard music from your very popular score for Chocolat. I don't suppose it's the only time you've had to compose music under extreme pressure.
No, but in fact, with Chocolat, I was under a very, very short amount of time. I only had 3.5 weeks. I came in late because there, as sometimes happens, composers, if the filmmakers feel that the composer hasn't quite got the gist of the film, they bring in somebody else. And I was brought in very close to the release date. And so I had to write. But I clicked with the film immediately. It was really easy to write, actually.
How much music did you have to compose in that 3.5 weeks?
Probably, I think it was about 45 minutes, which is a normal amount, sort of normal average amount for an hour and a half, 2 hour film.
So that's presumably working kind of round the clock.
Yeah, it kind of was working round the clock, yeah.
You were born in Lynchmere in Sussex in 1960. I don't think your parents were particularly musical, so how did you get the music bug?
I think my mother had a passionate interest in music, but she never played herself. And I think she poured all that interest into me, and I was the last of five children. So when I came along, she saw that I was musical. She really fostered that. And because she went to all the concerts locally and she also sought out the best music teachers, I was really lucky to have someone who was so interested, and she sat through all my lessons and all my practices.
And your mother was instrumental in getting you into Charterhouse School, which seems to have been exceptionally strong musically.
Exceptionally strong, yeah. They had a bursary for a young composer in residence there, who was a composer called Roger Steptoe, who arrived as a young man and at exactly the same time that I did. And I knocked on his stable door because he was in these sort of stables within the school grounds, and I started showing him these little pieces that I was writing. And he was a fabulous teacher, actually, because he was extremely encouraging and he would look and take anything seriously. And I really benefited from that. And when I got there, I was 15. So I had that sort of injection of really good musical teaching. I mean, the other music teachers were great there too.
I thought it was a boys' school at that time.
Well, it was a boys' school. It was a sort of kind of experiment at the beginning. They took a few girls and we were very wild and we got up to all sorts of mischief. And it was great. And to be honest, I didn't even understand the lessons or the teaching when I first got there from the school I'd come from. And so much happened in 2 years, but no, it was great.
During the week, along with your own music, we're going to hear music by composers who've been an influence on you. And today we're going to hear the slow movement of Ravel's Piano Concerto. Why this piece?
I first heard this piece when I was at Charterhouse. And I was introduced to Ravel by a teacher called Geoffrey Ford, who loved Ravel. And I had a visceral reaction to his music. I was so moved by it. And I'm interested in his orchestration, which is obviously legendary and beautiful. But what I particularly love about this slow movement is that it's steady pace throughout, and its beauty and its simplicity, although he does introduce sort of more complicated harmonies as it progresses. But the piano keeps this sort of steady movement throughout. Also, I love the piano, and I love its simplicity in this.
Rachel Portman, was there a moment that you can remember when you decided, I'm going to be a composer?
I think I made a decision to become a composer around the time, 15, 16, that I started really writing. Before, I'd written one or two little pieces, but then I really started writing more and more. And again, I was fortunate that I knew a composer, also quite young then, called Benedict Mason, who was going out with my older sister. And I saw what he was doing and I thought, I want to do that too. And I was very lucky to have someone in my life as well who was doing that.
In 1979, you left school and went to Worcester College, Oxford, to study music. Was that how you'd imagined it would be?
Not really. When I got there, the course was quite dry. I enjoyed the composing styles, and you know, and that was incredibly useful to me. All the harmony and all the palestrina and sort of finishing string quartets, that kind of thing. That was great for me. But the history was quite dry, I felt. And I went to Worcester College, but I wanted to go there because Robert Sherlock Johnson was the fellow there. And as a composer himself, I wanted to be writing music under him. But while he was a wonderful man and he was great at teaching orchestration, he wasn't not nearly so easy for me to share my music with. And he was quite discouraging because in those days, I think what he was looking for was composers who were going to write atonal music. And I really didn't want to. And so that was, I think, what started pushing me into thinking, well, maybe I'll do some theatre. And there was lots of theatre going on at Oxford at the time, lots of incredibly good, you know, student productions. So I find myself very busy in all my spare time writing music for theatre, really.
And you got involved in a film project, I think, with someone who's become rather closely associated with this area, with Hugh Grant.
Yes, absolutely. A bunch of students got together and made a full-length feature film and raised a small amount of money. And Hugh Grant was in it. And in fact, most of the team of us who were on it, we all doubled up with more than one job. But I was head of casting and crowd casting and obviously the composer. But, you know, the director and producer, everyone's gone on to have, you know, real careers in the film.
So how did you get started in writing music for the cinema?
Well, I suppose I just had a go and very quickly realised as soon as, you know, I'd done this one film that it was actually more exciting than I thought at the time, writing music for theatre, because there was more music, there were longer bits of music. They didn't keep getting shortened as the scene changes got faster. And I was just fascinated with the whole language of putting music against the moving picture. It's a really interesting, to me, combination together, integration. I really got a taste for it then, and I thought, right, that's what I want to do. To be honest, I don't know how I did it. I can't remember. It just happened naturally.
In 1986, you were commissioned to compose a setting of the Magnificat and the Nunc Dimittis for a broadcast of choral evensong. Did you find it easy?
Well, I think my background was I'd done quite a lot of singing in at school, sort of church singing and choral. You know, I'd been sung in choirs a lot, so I found it quite easy. And I, in that sense. And it's interesting for me looking back on it now because my life has changed so much and I feel I'm not nearly as close to the church as I might have been when I was growing up because I had to be because my parents took me to church. And it's interesting to me now that I would have done such a piece, really.
Rachel, back in the 1980s when you were just getting started, I imagine you had to do other jobs.
Yes, my 20s were really quite difficult. And jobs, though, the jobs that I got, whether they were radio commissions, you know, for radio drama, for example, or the odd film, there were huge gaps in between when it was really hard to keep going, but I was determined, completely determined to make my way. And in between, I did waitressing and cooking. I had a sister who was a cook director's lunches in the cities, in the city. And occasionally I'd step in for her. not nearly as competent and just wing it. And having been, I've been a vegetarian for years, and it was really hard having to arrive and then go out and sort of cook a meat lunch for eight people and deliver it. I think writing music is far simpler.
In 1988 came your first award. Tell me about that.
That was after I'd done the music for a series of Jim Henson's called The Storyteller, which it initially started with nine different Grimm's fairy tales written by Anthony Minghella and starring John Hurt, and with beautiful creatures from Jim Henson's workshop. And it was a large body of work, and I think as a result of that, I was awarded this BFI Anthony Asquith Award for being a young composer, which was great.
A couple of years on, you were working with Mike Lee on Life is Sweet. Yes. I think you found that a particularly challenging experience. Why was that?
Yes, I had worked with Mike Lee before. I'd done two or three things with him before, and then they were television things. This was a feature film. It was incredibly hard to write the music for this because it of the nature of the film and the fact that it's about a family. A lot of it is sort of like they're just chatting in a sitting room. And
he works without a script.
Absolutely.
So they improvise.
It's quite improvised,
they go
yes.
into the characters very deeply and then evolve the characters yeah. themselves.
Yeah, and this was a funny film, but it's also very much about the everyday, in a way. And that's incredibly hard to know how to write music for that. And so anyway, I started writing themes, and Mike was always nudging me to do this and do that, and he likes a tune. And I must have written about 10 or 12 tunes for Life is Sweet, and he'd come round every couple of days and he'd sit on my floor, and because I didn't have a sofa in those days, and he'd just shake his head and say, I'm so sorry, no, that's not right. And eventually I came up with the theme for it, and there was one little bit he wasn't happy with, and he sort of, like one little note, and I remember him humming to try and get me to go up there, so I did that. I thought, right, we're done, so which was good. But having done that, he's incredibly supportive as a filmmaker.
We're going to end today with a big leap forward, flying you to Los Angeles for your first big studio job there from the early 1990s. What was it like working in L.A.?
That'd be my dream, to go to America and to be, you know, paid to go to America to work on a film. And when it actually happened, I remember being in tears on the plane. I was so worried about doing something like that. It was completely different. The orchestras are totally different over there. You work with an enormous sort of orchestra. They play differently. The string players have a much more silky sound. There's less grit in the strings. It felt very grown up. And, you know, very serious. And
what age were you then?
I was 31 or 32. And it felt pressured in a way that it hadn't felt before, when I was the odd few films I'd done from the UK before.
Did it feel as if the stakes were higher? Somehow?
Yeah. I mean, you know, doing something for a studio, it was amazing. I remember the first film I did was at Fox, 20th Century Fox. And it was extraordinary because I was working on the studio lot. I was suddenly in this world with people, you know, walking around with planks and, you know, sort of facades of streets and all this history, film history.
Yeah.
And I've never been a film historian, but it was extraordinary to be immersed in it.
We'll hear a track from the film Benny and June, starring Johnny Depp playing a latter-day Buster Keaton. Rachel, yesterday we followed you to the USA for the first time. You've since worked on many scores for Hollywood films. Is all that transatlantic travel and living away from home for long periods something that you just accept as part of the territory, or do you resent it?
I've got very good at it, at sort of dealing with or minimising jet lag and that kind of thing. When I first started writing music for films in LA, I used to go out and sort of decamp there and spend about 5-6 weeks there for each film. And then I had kids, and so for a few times I took one and then two out with me when I went. And then
that must have been really complicated in terms of schools and
well,
all that
when they
stuff,
were tiny, right? I'm talking about when they were like two, three, okay. You know, I had them quite close together. So, right. And I remember a particular time when I went, when Anna, my oldest, she was two and a half. And then I had a newborn as well. So like she was about Julia, who was 4 or 5 months. And I was working on a Disney film and we rented a little place and it was awful because I could deal with my own jet lag and I could be up and ready for the next day and writing. But of course, they weren't. They were all over the place. And I took a nanny with me and she had to sleep at night. And so I was up with the girls at night and then trying to work the next day. One day when I was away at the studio writing, and I think they'd been to the beach or something really wonderful, we came back to all at the same time and I could see that this little house had been broken into. So I called the police, 911, and I just got a mobile phone. It was like I hadn't thought of having one till then. I think it was just when they were coming in. And the police arrived and they were in the house for a very long time. And when they came out, they were ashen. And they said, there's a dead body in the pool. There was a little pool at the back. Yeah, which was just awful. And it was like being, I don't know, it's like being in an episode of LAPD or something.
Well, the whole Sunset thing was, Boulevard.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely, exactly. Blimey. It was awful and incredibly sad. Luckily, we didn't see it and we went to stay with some friends after that. But after that, I'd always had a sort of strange relationship with LA. I always felt it was slightly unsafe. I don't know why. And I thought, right, I'm not going to take the girls with me anymore. And I'll do all my writing from the UK, and except for the odd, very occasional week if a director really pressed me to go and be out there. And I'll just go and do 2-3 day trips. So write from the UK and go and have meetings, but then come back. And so I've made my base here after that.
We're going to hear Terra Magica from The Adventures of Pinocchio. This is a version of a story, The Tale of a Misfit, directed by Steve Barron and a truly international project. I guess one of the really transformative projects in your whole career right at the beginning was working with Jim Henson of Muppets fame on the Storyteller project.
It was a wonderful project because there were originally 9 half-hour Grimm's fairy tales and each one was directed by a different director. So I got to work with a large pool of really good directors. I think one, if not two, were directed by Jim Henson himself, who's a wonderful man. And I had to conjure up these different worlds and evil and good. And I mean, it was a real feast of a journey for me. Mm. And I remember in particular on this story called The Soldier and Death, there was a soldier who was given, according to Anthony Minghella in the script, a ruby whistle. So when he whistled, it sounded like rubies. And we had terrible trouble in creating
what does a ruby
human
sound like?
Yeah, exactly. And we searched and searched and we got various people to come up to the microphone. People brought in who were really great whistlers and who whistled. We were like shaking our heads. And then one night Jim Henson said he would do it. He said, no, it's like people, no, I think I can do it, you know. And he came along and he whistled, and we were all dying in the back, shaking shoulders, laughing so much because it was so bad. But he was so wonderful. And in the end, Mike Sam from Mike Sam Singers came along, and he had a great idea, which was to whistle the whole thing at half speed, which we then speeded up, and it went up an octave.
Oh, wow.
And he was listening to the backing track but with headphones, whistling along. And do you know, it really did sound like Ruby's.
One of the perpetual problems you face all the time is simply lack of time. I mean, I'm guessing at its most generous, you maybe have 6 weeks to work on a film score.
Yeah, it can be between 6 weeks to 3 months. Some really big projects go on. You know, I've been known to work on a film for over a year with Jonathan Demme. So it depends, but usually it's very pressured. Even on a sort of slightly longer one, like a three-monther, you can still be under terrible pressure as the cuts change, as, you know, you get to the end and directors come back with new changes or new scenes, that kind of thing.
We're sitting in your studio here with a rather magnificent piano and a rather magnificent microphone, actually, has to be said. So presumably the mechanics of the thing are that you record the piano track, as it were, of what you want, and then you hand this over to other people to flesh out?
It's quite unusual the way I work, because I tend to... I sit at the piano, I have a copy of the film which I can control to go backwards and forwards, so I can go over and over a scene as I work on it and until it feels right. And I play on the piano along with it, usually free. So I don't have any electronic equipment here at all other than recording. So I play free, and then that becomes the blueprint. My recording, my piano recording, becomes the blueprint for what will end up being the finished piece of music. So from that piece of music, I go from a piano score to I orchestrate on a short orchestration. So I used to have time. Anyway, in the days of Benny and June and Emma to do absolutely everything and orchestrate everything, but there just isn't time. So you have to work with an orchestrator, which can be good too. But I specify as much as I can in short score. But it's always the original piano recording in its length that fits exactly where it's in sync with the film that is then what we end up recording in the recording studio.
Well, throughout the week, we're hearing choices of music by other composers, which mean a lot to you today. You've chosen Shostakovich and his first violin concerto.
Yeah, I think we're going to hear the Passacaglia, which is the third movement, and in a recording by Nicola Benedetti. And I had a visceral reaction again to the way she played and the piece itself. And there's something about it's a piece of real maturity, I feel. And I can't help feeling that there's something of Shostakovich's soul which she's interpreting, which I really received in the way I heard it. It's really sad. I also think that there's something, to me, some kind of searching for understanding. There's something very humane about the piece.
Rachel, looking at your list of film and TV credits in the 90s, things were really taking off for you. And in 1996, you composed the score for the film of Jane Austen's novel Emma, directed by Douglas McGrath and starring Gwyneth Paltrow and Jeremy Northam. Your score won an Oscar, making you the first woman composer ever to win one of those so sought-after gold statuettes. It's rather charming to see him standing in your kitchen. What was it like being at the ceremony and finding yourself the winner?
I couldn't believe that I had been included in this extraordinary sort of glittery event. And I mean, everything about it, I just sort of drank it in while I was there, you know, the stretch limo going, you know, on the freeway to the Oscars. And it had a sunroof in it. And I stood up, and as far as I looked, going forwards and backwards in five lanes were stretch limos. You couldn't believe it. I mean, it was extraordinary to be a part of it, you know, from, you know, not being in that world myself, because I don't really feel, I mean, you're not part of that world really as a composer. I sit with my piano most of the time. And, you know, when I won, that was extraordinary. It's a blur.
Was it a shock?
It was a bit of a shock. And also I was seated really quite a long way from the stage where I had to walk. And I had a cameraman in front of me walking backwards. And it was taking an awful long time to walk to the stage. I mean, it's like the Royal Albert Hall, but bigger, you know, and I was right at the back. But I didn't realise that on television they were showing a clip of Emma at that time. Oh. But I was in a panic to get there.
And not trip, yeah. What about choosing the dress, given that there's going to be all this ridiculous competition?
Well, you know, I think I was so busy. I ran off to a shop, chose a dress and put it on and went off. You know, I was so, so busy. The dress was not the main thing. It was great to be, you know, it was great to go to the parties and be a part of it. It was an extraordinary evening. And you jump all the queues of everybody trying to get into these big Oscar parties. If you're holding a statue,
they're
just like, oh, come in, you know. And the other thing that I found interesting, in fact, I found it interesting, I went again a few years later and I didn't win. And it was really funny and interesting to see what it was like not to win, because I was much more aware of all the other people who didn't win and much more aware of the fact that at these parties, 4/5 of the people at the parties hadn't won. So there's this kind of sort of dampening kind of feel to quite a lot of the people who were there. You know, seeing people put their acceptance speeches, you know, that they secretly got in their lap and folding them up and putting them back in their pocket when they didn't win. It's funny.
Take me through the general process of how you compose a film score. Is it always the same process?
I would say it's always different. I mean, every story is different. Every film has a different character. It depends on the director. When I worked, for example, when I worked with Doug McGrath on Emma, he's incredibly specific about placement of music, and in particular, placement of comedy music. And Emma, it is a sort of a comedy. And I remember there's a scene in particular where Emma is talking to her friend Harriet and they're sewing under this beautiful canopy. It's a really beautiful scene. And Emma is sort of suggesting to Harriet that she should consider Mr. Elton as a possible suitor. And Harriet's being really quite sort of dippy about, oh, really? Do you think so? And I wrote this very simple sort of like folk-like tune, but I had to be so precise where each note came in. And it was up to me, really, the orchestration. I could do that. And I used bassoons and things that were quite funny in pizzicato in a very simple way. But I placed it so carefully around the dialogue because their dialogue was full of pauses. And it was a long, complicated scene. And the music is quite long underneath it. And it's working intricately with the dialogue. That's unusual to do that. But it's really fun.
What sort of difference did winning the Oscar actually make to you? Does the phone then start ringing?
It did, actually. And I think it opened doors. And, you know, very soon after that, Jonathan Demme got in touch and said he'd like me to do the score for Beloved. And projects just flowed after that.
You've mentioned working with Jonathan Demme on the film Beloved, based on Toni Morrison's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name, which tells the horrifying story of a former slave in the aftermath of the Civil War. This was a really big, challenging, year-long project. Yeah. You've said it was a collaboration which pushed you into new areas.
When I met Jonathan, he said he would love me to do the score, but he didn't want me to use any Western classical instruments at all, and he wanted any music to derive from Africa. So I went on, I came on board really early, and I went on this huge search for interesting instruments, and I did recordings. We worked with the Malian singer Oumou Sangaré, and we worked with a percussion troupe actually from Haiti. I worked with the African Children's Choir. I went to Paris. I worked with musicians from Mali there, and we worked with mbiras and choras, and so it was like a rolling recording, putting the music together for this. I discovered quickly, fairly soon afterwards, that a lot of African instruments only play one note, or they're really, really only one tonality, or it would be a flute that would only play three notes. And so I then went to the voice, because I knew I'd be okay with that. And it seemed to go with the story of Beloved. But I incorporated kora into it, and the marimba, I've forgotten the name of the African marimba, but it was a huge journey. And at the end, it's a very, very dark story. And in the end, I wanted to put some hope into it, which is why I used the children from the African Children's Choir. And they sang this song, which is, we all made up the words together, which is called Uhuru, which is freedom, means freedom.
''99 saw the release of one of your most successful films, The Cider House Rules, directed by Lassie Hallström and based on the novel by John Irving. I know that this is a score that's really special to you.
It is. I think, well, firstly, it's a wonderful book and a wonderful story. But it turned out to be a very beautiful film as well and very moving on many levels. And the music itself has had its own life, sort of unconnected to the film as well. It's been used in America on a commercial for years. And also, a lot of people listen to it outside with the soundtrack, which has been nice for me. In fact, I even had a letter from a soldier in the US Army who'd done 8 years of tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, who said that he used to listen to it at night, and it gave him sort of calm and peace, the main theme of it. That's really meaningful for me to receive something like that.
You've mentioned this absolutely beautiful theme, picked up, I think, by the Pure Michigan and used in their tourism adverts. When you composed this theme, did you have a sense at the time that you'd really nailed it?
Well, actually, this film was quite a complex film. And like the novel, it's a story that goes through many different sort of periods in it. And I originally wrote a whole score and we recorded it with one theme, and there was just like 2 to 4 bars of what became the main theme of one little piece of music that we recorded. And the director said, "Rachel, we need to rescore this film. It needs more music. It needs another theme." And he said, "What about that little tiny..." And it was just like the end of a phrase almost. And that was what I used, and I expanded that. And that became the main theme in the end.
Thank you. Rachel, we were talking a little bit about your use of the piano, and we're sitting in your studio here with this magnificent Bösendorfer in front of us. There's quite an interesting story about how it got here.
Yes. I was on board to write the score for a Disney film called Mulan around the same time as, well, I just had Anna, and I was pregnant with my second daughter, and Disney got wind of this. And the dates of recording for Mulan fell fairly close to my due date, and they said that they were uncomfortable about me writing the score anymore. And I said that was absolutely fine at the time. And they came back to me and said they would like to offer me a large sum of money in lieu of having been fired from it. I hadn't actually started. And because I got this sum of money for nothing, I thought, right, I'm going to do something really special with it. And so I had an upright piano, and I thought what I would really love would be a grand Bösendorfer. And so I bought one, and I went to Vienna and chose one from a lined up group of beautiful pianos. And someone from the Vienna Conservatoire came and played them all. But I knew which one I wanted already, because it was so beautiful.
In the year 2000, you worked with Robert Redford on the film The Legend of Bagger Vance, a sports drama starring Will Smith, Matt Damon and Charlize Theron, who was also in Cider House Rules. The screenplay is based on the 1995 book The Legend of Bagger Vance, a novel of golf and the game of life. It's set in Georgia in 1931, and I believe there's a rather interesting story about how you were hired for the film.
Oh, yes. Robert Redford, who likes to be called Bob, but I didn't know him as that. I was told that he was interested in me writing the music for his film, and they were on the set. They were going to be shooting somewhere, I can't remember, sort of south of New York on a golf course. And so I took a plane out to New York, and then I took a second plane, and I got there in the middle of the night, and I was incredibly late and tired, and I was picked up by a set driver and thought, oh, I'll be taken to my hotel, you know, and then I'll meet with Robert the next day. But no, he said, well, Bob's waiting for you on set. And so I thought, oh, no, and I had a terrible headache. And I turned up, and I had to go into his trailer where he was. And I had this pounding headache, and I couldn't think. Anyway, he's a very, very charming man. He sat down and he just said, so what do you think of the script? And I thought, oh, my God, you know, what am I going to say to this amazing man. I said I thought it was wonderful. And then, you know, we chatted for about 10 minutes, and then he said, I think it'd be nice if we went out onto the set now. So we went out, and it was night, and they were doing a golf sort of putting shot, as far as I can see, on this green. And I sat in the tent next to him, and I was up all night with him. And the next day, I heard that he was very happy for me to do the score. He hadn't really interviewed me or asked me about anything. I think he just wanted to meet me. But so I had this extraordinary long no sleep forever that went on forever. But he was a wonderful man to work with, and he told wonderful anecdotes and was extremely generous. Thank you.
We've just heard music from The Human Stain. That was, I believe, a film that you particularly enjoyed working on.
Yeah, I really enjoyed working with Robert Benton, the director, who sadly died now. He directed Kramer vs. Kramer. He's a wonderful man. And he loved everything I did immediately as soon as I did it, as soon as I wrote anything. And actually, he was very easy to please like that, which was lovely. So I had a real freedom on this score. And it takes place in a lot of sort of icy, snowy, wide landscapes. And it's a film with a lot of pain in it. And I used a prepared piano in it. I mean, there's a normal piano, there's a regular piano, but there's also a prepared piano in there, which you can just hear sort of adds to the iciness.
I wonder if there was a point in your career where you decided to stop writing music for the concert hall, or whether you were just swamped with film work and that got pushed out.
I think that's what happened. I think I just got pulled more and more into film. And I came to a point where I thought, I really want to diversify more and work outside film. And by this time I had three young children, and I was really interested in writing an opera that you could take a child to, that they would really enjoy and not be put off by, which I think some of the repertoire can be. So I was searching for a subject to write.
And along came this operatic adaptation of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's enchanting story, yeah, The Little Prince, a commission from Houston Grand Opera. How did, yes, that come about?
Oh, that came about, it was actually through my publisher, Jim Keller, who works also under Philip Glass's publishing company. And Philip had been approached to write an opera of The Little Prince. And I'd met Philip, and Philip actually suggested me. And that's how it came about. Because I'd been searching, and Jim knew I was searching for something. And it was the perfect, I mean, really, the perfect subject for an opera. And so I worked with Nicholas Wright on the libretto. And at the beginning, in the original talks with the director, Francesca Zambello, she was very keen that we would have a young soprano sing the Little Prince. And I thought that would be completely against everything that I thought. If a child is going to be taken to see an opera, they want to see a child. Mm-hmm. And it was really important for me. So I wrote the music very carefully so that this child, you know, who's on stage virtually the whole way through the opera, he has quite short pieces to sing. And, you know, amazingly, it's been performed many times. And the calibre of the boys that sing the Little Prince, they're so professional. It was a wonderful journey, and it took a year and a half. And it's an extraordinary story, and one that, by keeping in touch with, and I mean sort of thinking about Saint-Exupéry's words, has such deep meaning for us in our lives now, I think.
My water bottle's empty. If we don't find a well, we'll die of thirst.
But my friend the fox once told me,
little fellow, this has nothing to do with the fox.
Even if you're going to die, it's good to have had a friend.
He didn't realize that angel never hungry, never thirsty. All he needed was a little sunlight.
I'm thirsty too. Let's look for a well. It can't be far. We'll find it beneath my star.
Rachel, that experience of composing for and working with children, how did you find that?
I love writing for children. I mean, I'm really interested in music that connects with children and having children's voices. And it's something I want to do more of and have done quite a bit of as well. Working with them, it's amazing what you can give children to sing. The choruses of stars in The Little Prince, the children sing cranes as well. The children learnt those pieces in a short amount of time. In fact, we did the BBC did a talent search for children to be in The Little Prince for the film that they made. And children auditioned at various points all over the UK. And they were chosen. I can't remember how many exactly there were, probably about 20 or 30. And we also found the little boy, Joseph McManus, through that process. And the children, had an amazing time learning it. And they loved working with the grown-ups, and the grown-ups loved working with the children. And they all learned lessons from each other. And
it was a wonderful, blowing that great myth of never working.
Absolutely, yes. No, no. And, you know, we included children who would never have had a chance to be in something like that. And then other children who were very highly trained, who, you know, so it was a real mishmash of people brought together who worked really hard to produce something of top quality.
Well, the year after The Little Prince's premiere, 2004, came The Manchurian Candidate, a Cold War suspense thriller, and another collaboration with Jonathan Demme, the piece now updated to the period after the Gulf War. Your previous collaboration with Demme on Beloved had been a terrific experience for you, challenging but ultimately rewarding. But this project brought further boundary pushes, I guess.
This was quite a troubled film at the time, or trouble for me. And Jonathan told me that he wanted, you know, it's a very frightening film. It's about mind control and about war. And from my early discussions with him, he said he wanted a very intellectualized, sort of scary kind of music. And I took that to mean sort of Hitchcockian. And I wrote a whole score. We recorded it with the orchestra in London. He didn't come, which was always a mistake, actually. If a director isn't there, if they're too busy, it's very rare that they don't come, actually. And I was out in New York a couple of weeks later going through the film with him with this music. And then he said to me, you know, I don't think it's working. At which point I had a very, very sort of short amount of time to write another score. And I just wasn't sure what he wanted, and he couldn't communicate it. And we were sitting around, and then he just said to me, I need something visceral. And the minute he said that word, that one word, visceral, I knew exactly what to do. I said, just give me a couple of weeks. I came back and I sat and I wrote this huge score. And my benchmark of writing was whether I was feeling scared as I was writing it. And it was actually quite easy to do after that. And we compiled lots of strange sounds and sort of like high squealing soprano sax and quarter tone sort of cellos and basses sort of weaving around quarter tones around these sort of dark, dark chords. And I found my way through, but it was a huge film, and it was really sort of scary when I was in that whole thing of whether I could actually cling on to this film or whether I was going to be fired this time around, because it's not a comfortable position to be in. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. It's not often I can begin a programme with a battle of watermelons, but I can today because all this week I'm featuring the music of film composer par excellence Rachel Portman, and that was the rather jolly Battle of the Watermelons from her score for the 2001 film The Emperor's New Clothes, directed by Alan Taylor and starring Ian Holm as the Emperor of France. The multiple award-winning Rachel Portman, best known for her music for the cinema and first woman winner of an Oscar for her score for the film version of Jane Austen's Emma, is my guest all this week. Today, we're going to be exploring the music she's written since the year 2000. Rachel, I'd like to talk first today about your collaboration on the film Oliver Twist, directed by Roman Polanski, to a screenplay by Ronald Harwood. What was your relationship with Polanski like?
It was very interesting working with him. One of the things that I asked him when we first met was, this is a very dark film, it's a very dark story. And I said, how dark can I go with the music? You know, for a film like this, it's a book that is written, read by children and will be seen by children, has a child in it. And he said, well, in his view, he said, well, look at the Disney cartoon version of Snow White. He said, there's nothing more terrifying that's ever been made. And actually, he's right. It's a terrifying film. However, I wouldn't go to the extremes of something like Manchurian Candidate in scoring a film like Oliver Twist. Oliver Twist isn't as scary anyway, but there is real darkness in it.
Polanski has directed opera and I know understands music, and I think you felt there was a kind of special quality in your relationship with him.
Yeah, he gave me absolute freedom to... He wasn't at all worried about how I would orchestrate anything that I was playing him. I was writing on the piano and I said... So he knew the themes and he said, oh, don't worry, you don't need to tell me about the orchestration. I know you can orchestrate. And that's unusual because... I think it's because he has such a... He's so confident in his own musicality that he could hear... If I said, oh, well, that's going to be... this, you know, the main theme is going to be on a clarinet here, or this is going to be woodwind and this is going to be whatever. I could describe it to him. And he felt utterly comfortable, whereas a lot of directors, especially, you know, nowadays, they want all the music demoed up, mocked up, so that they can hear, be absolutely sure of what they're going to hear. In his case, he's not bothered. It was lovely to work with someone who understood rhythm and music so well. I'd be sitting, I'd go over to Paris and he'd be there, you know, and we'd sit with the editor and we'd be discussing music, but he'd say, no, we've got to make that cut right there. You know, with the editor, he'd get sidetracked because he was really interested in the rhythm of a shot as well.
Rachel, when you're involved in working on a given film score, it's obviously a very intense experience because you're always working to deadlines. On average, how much music will you have to compose in very often a matter of weeks?
That's a really difficult question to answer. It really depends. I mean, I generally think there's too much music in films and that it increasingly... especially for, you know, sort of larger American films, you know, there's a sort of reliance on, you know, almost everything being scored all the way through. And I think it's more interesting to let the audience work a bit harder and not be telegraphing anything or too much. But to answer your question, normally it's between 45 minutes to 55 minutes for a normal 1.5, 90-minute, 100-minute film. I would say music, that sort of average.
The business of working on scores in the intensive way that you do is a very special business altogether. And I guess if you're working on subjects that are as dark as the Manchurian Candidate or parts of Oliver Twist. I mean, that must have an enormous impact on your life when you immerse yourself in that kind of world for week after week.
Yeah, it's true. I sort of live and work. I live the stories in a way, or by day, you know. And I mean, there are also lighter versions of that. For example, when I was working on Chocolat, even though it was very brief, I ate a lot of chocolate. And, yeah.
Did it help?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
What kind of chocolate?
Oh, any chocolate I could get my hands on, actually, because it was I was so hungry. And then there's so much chocolate happening on the screen. Mm. So, you know.
During this week, we're hearing your choices of music, which has influenced you or inspired you. We've heard Ravel and Shostakovich so far. And today you've chosen music by Thea Musgrave, her Songs for a Winter's Evening. Mm. What is it in these songs that speaks to you?
I think they're quite simply ravishingly beautiful. And I think they're just beautiful settings. And there's something about the voice and the very fluid orchestration surrounding the singing that is, I don't know, a beautiful kind of freedom in her writing that you don't often hear.
Rachel, we're going to hear next an extract from a major work of yours, a choral symphony, which was a commission for the 2007 season of the BBC Proms. It's called The Water Diviner's Tale, which you call an ecological music drama. How did that come about in the first place?
Do you know, I'm not sure I can remember how that came about. Well, it was a very exciting commission, and I worked with Owen Shears, a poet who I've collaborated, collaborating since as well, and it was semi-dramatised, and we used a chorus of 40 children who sang the main sort of lost children in it. There was a narrator, there were 5 soloists, and then huge youth choir drawn from different choirs, and all on the subject of really of climate change and stories of water. And again, with that, we did, like The Little Prince, when we filmed The Little Prince, we did a sort of talent search for the 40 children, and they learnt it in 2 weeks. I loved working again with children on this, and it was amazing to see the calibre of what they could do. And the bit we're going to hear is about the Song of Industry, where this little boy could hear oil, gas, and it's about the businessmen and the scientists who get very excited and then use all this technology, and it sort of builds up into this huge mechanised piece. It speaks to what I'm really interested in, which is what we're doing to this planet. That's something I'm very passionate about.
How did you arrive at this choice of subject and then working with a particular collaborator?
I wanted to write a piece with and collaborate with the poet Owen Shears, and we're both very passionate about ecological issues and climate change in particular. And so it was out of that that the commission came about. And I mean, it was an hour long sort of dramatic sort of oratorio using children. And Owen and I have got various projects that we're collaborating on in the future as well, and often with a sort of an environmental theme in mind.
It must have been amazing hearing the piece performed in that extraordinary space. What was the reaction at the time?
I think it went down very well. We filled the Royal Albert Hall with voices and orchestra. It was incredibly exciting. We had a huge audience, and it was wonderful.
Rachel, we're going to finish today with your music from the film The Duchess from 2008, directed by Saul Diblin, starring Keira Knightley. The music was recently added to the A-level syllabus. How does that kind of thing happen?
Well, apparently a girl who's studying for A-level music complained, obviously, to the examination board that there were no female composers to be studied. That's how that came about. So I became one of, I think, two or three to be included, which is great.
It must have been quite a surprise.
Yeah, it's a real surprise. Yeah.
The Duchess is a period piece, like Oliver Twist. Do you approach period films in any sense in a different way?
I think I have, approached period films in a different way than I would a contemporary film. Certainly in the soundscape or the sound world of I probably wouldn't put a guitar in, for example, like an electric guitar or that kind of thing. But I'm not sure those rules need to be, or those, they're my own self-imposed rules. I'm not sure I would feel I would have to do that now. But sort of certainly going back, and certainly when I did The Duchess, I would have thought along those lines.
When you're doing a piece like that, do you immerse yourself in music of the period to get not that you're going to imitate anything, but just to get a sense of the sound world?
I don't think I do, actually. I think more than anything, I immerse myself in the story in the film, and then I see what happens. It's about, sort of connecting really deeply with a story and all the elements that are there. Because when I start writing music for a film, nearly always the film is there in front of me. So I've got all the elements. The music is one of the last things to be put on. It's always the sound that happens at the end of a film. And so I'm really trying to attune to that world.
Music by Rachel Portman for a Chinese film called Snowflower and the Secret Fan, set in both 19th century China and in present-day Shanghai, and directed by Wayne Wang. Rachel, you composed that music in 2011. The score included an erhu, a two-stringed bowed Chinese fiddle. Presumably you had to find out about the instrument and what it was capable of.
I did a little. I certainly didn't study it or anything like that, but it's the second time I've used an erhu. And in fact, on a previous Wayne Wang film called The Joy Luck Club, I did as well. And I wanted to use it within the context of a more Western score, but with Chinese sort of melodic inferences, which is sort of what I did, which I think is a way to translate a Chinese flavour to a sort of Western audience who are going to be watching, more likely to be watching the film anyway.
In 2010, you became the first woman to win a top honour for film and TV composers awarded by BMI. Maybe you could explain what that is, what the initials stand for.
They stand for Broadcast Music Inc. And they are the performing arts body, a bit like the PRS. And it was a real honour to have a tribute from them, you know, for my work. Felt a bit young for me to be having it at the tender age of whatever I was then, 49. But very nice nonetheless.
2010 was a pretty big year. This was the time when you got to go to Buckingham Palace to pick up a rather splendid gong.
I did. That was very wonderful. It was an OBE, and I was given it by Prince Charles. And he was so gracious in the way he said. He said something to absolutely everybody who went up at, for all the different people. And, you know, actually, I just felt it was very personal the way he said, "I'm so glad you won this." And more than anything, it was amazing to be part of a lot of people who were there for, you know, for work in social services or in, you know, sort of the army or that kind of thing. And I felt very humbled being part of it. It wasn't a big glitzy day of sort of what you would think of as famous people winning or not or being awarded honours.
We're going to hear a selection of music next from the film Never Let Me Go from that year, 2010, an adaptation for the big screen of Kazuo Ishiguro's novel directed by Mark Romanek. I think this is one of your favourite scores.
Yeah, it is. It's one of my favourite scores. I was deeply affected by this film. And, you know, we talked about how working on a film, you can be really soak yourself in the film, but actually become a part of the film. And I think all of us who worked on this film were really affected by the story and the pain of the story. And I think it's a very beautifully made film. It was quite a difficult film. It didn't do as much business as I wish it had, but it's incredibly well respected as a piece of cinema now.
One should say this is a very dark story indeed, which begins with three seemingly ordinary teenagers in a seemingly ordinary boarding school, but it very slowly emerges that they have been bred to be organ donors.
Yeah, that's correct. But actually, what the film is really about, which is, I think, what Ishiguro's writing is so brilliant at, is it's about being human, and it's about love, and it's about how much time we have to, you know, to be with somebody else and how much time we have to love them. And so that was very much the tack I took in the music. My music was very much concerned with that.
Rachel, we're going now to move away from the world of film to enter the concert hall. Yesterday we heard from your work, The Water Diviner's Tale, a commission for the BBC Proms. It's a difficult change of gear, I guess, jumping from composing for film to writing for the concert hall.
It is different, and it depends whether I would be setting text or whether I'm actually making up my own programmatic sort of story. And that's something I had to do with Endangered. You know, I could choose from various environmental themes, and Endangered Species was the one I chose for this. So I soaked myself in watching films about overfishing, logging, poaching of elephants, and I sort of came up with my own story. It's essentially the same in a sense, but it's just you kind of have to work harder to make sure that you're doing something that actually works sort of cohesively.
But it must be terrifically liberating for you to be freed from both everything being predicated on visual cues, and also to have the autonomy, not to be writing to suit what a director has envisaged for you.
It really is. And, you know, it's something that interests me hugely. And I am going to do more and more of, because I have that freedom. And I really want to be writing my music. And this gives me a chance to do that, obviously.
Well, after Endangered, we're going to hear A Christmas Carol. This involved your working with the poet Michael Morpurgo.
With Michael Morpurgo, yeah, and I, we've worked together on a film. We have a couple of projects in the pipeline together. And it was just a snowy day, and I just suddenly thought, he believes in the power of singing and how important it is for people to get together and sing. And I just said to him one day, you know, Michael, what about writing a carol? And he said, well, I'm quite busy at the moment, but I'll have a think about it. And I think he might have been in Switzerland or something. And the next day, he sent me the words for this, which was great. So he acted on it very quickly.
Rachel, looking back on your very distinguished career in films beginning in the 1980s, has the industry changed much?
The industry has changed enormously. I would say where I've noticed it most is in the medium budget sized films, which don't seem to exist anymore. There's either the really enormous films, often, you know, some sequels and, you know, and then they're the sort of more like European or British films, which are made on a shoestring. And there used to be a healthier budget for the kind of films that are made now on, you know, for very, very little money. And so I find myself scrabbling around to think, you know, how can we record this as quickly as possible? Where can we go? And yeah, there just isn't the cushion. There aren't the cushions that there used to be.
With the kind of track record that you have, Oscar winner and all the rest of it, I mean, you're presumably now able to be very choosy about which projects you take on. Are there things that you definitely wouldn't want to get on board?
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I've always been quite picky, and the same is true now. And there's also, there's a whole thing of repeating oneself, that in film, I'm interested in diversifying and new things. And so I would be, you know, if I was offered something very similar that didn't really, you know, that I felt I've done that, you know, I would probably say no.
I believe you're currently training in a altogether different, maybe parallel career.
Yeah, I've done a training. It's now complete, a psychotherapy training. And I've been doing it sort of part-time over about 5 years. And I asked myself how I got into that and how what and I sort of found myself doing it. And I think there's a similarity between my music and what I've been doing for years and psychotherapy, in that whenever I've been working on a subject for music, I've really had to understand a character or a world or a story or, you know, a novel or a place. And so you have to really attune to it. And there's something very similar in the way that you work in psychotherapy, which is you really attune to somebody's psyche and their story as well. And I think both will feed one will feed the other. And I think I will take a lot from that understanding of the psyche into my bring it back into my music.
Rachel Portman, thank you very much indeed for having us in your studio all this week.
Thank you.